Hello, little girl. Hello, little girl. Hello, little girl. When I see you every day, I say...
Recognize this song? It's one of the Beatles' early recordings, Hello, Little Girl. You can hear John, Paul, George, and Pete. That's right, Pete Best, the Beatles' drummer before Ringo Starr. In fact, it was Pete's mother, Mona, who played a key role in the formation of the band. When she opened the Casbah Coffee Club in the basement of her house in Liverpool, she went looking for an opening night band. George Harrison and Ken Brown recruited two old buddies, John Lennon and Paul McCartney. They called themselves the Quarrymen. Not long after that, Pete Best became the group's drummer. Why Pete Best was kicked out of the band remains something of a mystery to this day, but one thing's clear. For Pete, the timing could not have been worse. Just a few months after he left the band in the summer of 62, the Beatles landed their first number one hit, Love Me Do, and they soon went on to make music history. And Pete Best? Well, he kicked around with a few bands before settling into a career as a civil servant in Liverpool. In 1988, Pete once again picked up his drumsticks and formed the Pete Best Band. And now he's put out a book called The Beatles, The True Beginnings. He told Steve Paulson that he joined the Beatles right before they went to Hamburg.
I got a phone call from Paul McCartney, which basically turned around and said, you know, we've got the offer to go to Germany. Would you be interested in taking over the drummer's role? And I said, yeah, I am interested, but I'll check it out with my own boys and, you know, my parents. They turned around and said, yes, if it's what you want to do, go with our blessings. And I phoned Paul back and turned around and said, yep, I'm in. And Paul turned around and said, well, yes, you might be in, but you've got to audition. And I went down the following day to the Wyvern Club, which later became the Blue Angel. My younger brother Rory was with me. I threw my drums in the taxi, got down there, played about six numbers that consisted of the audition. And after about 10 minutes, they went away in a corner, had a little bit of a tete-a-tete. And then they came back and turned around and said, Pete, you're in. And that's the way I acquired the drummer's role with the Beatles.
What kind of people were John, Paul and George?
George was the youngest guy. Even from, you know, the first instance, he was very much into wanting to improve his guitar technique. So he was rehearsing, practicing, making sure he wanted to be the best guitarist around. Paul, very much the PR orientated guy, wanted the public to know, the world to know what was happening. Again, a brilliant musician, very self-assured, very self-composed. John was the, I suppose you could turn around and say, the clown of the band. He had this sardonic, caustic-witted humour. And it was something which was, you know, I took a liking to because I became, you know, very close to John. But I actually saw another side of John, which was a very tender and a very loving side. And when you actually put those two components together, John was the complete person as far as I was concerned.
Now, you played with the Beatles for a couple of years, from 1960 to 62. How much of the Beatles' essential sound do you think was established during that period?
I think the vast majority of it, to be quite honest, simply because of the fact that, the kindred hours we put in, you know, the killing hours we did in Germany, that was the welding, that was the fusion. We were playing six, 7 hours a night, six, seven nights a week, you know. Even if you didn't realise it, it was taking place. We were becoming tight, we were becoming energetic. The sound was improving, it was becoming more raw, it was becoming more powerhouse and more savage. The image was changing. And of course, it was through that hard schooling in Hamburg. When we came back to Liverpool, you know, and we were doing exactly the same as we did in Hamburg, it just basically took the Liverpool audiences by storm. So really, you know, the sound and the creation, the early creation I'm talking about, took place during the, you know, those two kindred years.
Now, you played a lot of gigs with the Beatles, both in Liverpool and in Germany. Weren't you also, for a while, handling the books? You were actually the manager, in a sense?
Yes, I assumed the mantle prior to Brian Epstein, and I handled the business side of things.
One day in August of 1962, Brian Epstein told you that you were out. You were no longer going to be part of the Beatles, and Ringo Starr was going to replace you. Was this a complete surprise?
It was, simply because the fact there'd been no real forewarning at all about it. I'd been with the band for 2 years. We'd recorded with Polydor. We'd got the recording contract with EMI. It did come as a complete surprise because, you know, all of this was taking place. We were on an upward roll. We decided on what our first release was going to be, which was Love Me Doing, P.S. I Love You. But then I was called into the office around about mid-August 1962, and one night I was a Beatle, and the next morning I was no longer there.
Why do you think that happened? Why were you fired?
I don't know. I mean, the reason that was given, that I wasn't a good enough drummer, has never held up water. Never will. And there's lots of people in Liverpool who support me from that particular area. And even today, you know, travelling around the world and playing with my own band, the Pete Best Band, they've looked at my drumming ability and basically turned around and said, no, you have a style of your own, which was very credible. You know, you were rated and reputed to be one of the best drummers in Liverpool. We can see why. So that particular aspect of it never held up water.
Now, there have been a couple of other explanations that have been put forward. One is that the other Beatles were actually jealous of you because you were this good-looking guy and apparently a lot of the girls flocked around you. And another explanation is that you didn't quite fit in with the rest of the lads, that you held yourself a little bit separate.
I think that's hard to sort of swallow as well. Again, this is things which people sort of point out and they try and, you know, turn around and say that was the reason for it. They may have assumed it. Something which happened in Hamburg, people have got hold of it. I think in Hamburg, people turned around and said I was a little bit of a loner. I was alone simply because of the fact I was a drummer. I broke sticks. I used to have to go into town by myself. I was the one who used to get out of bed early, right? The others were still there. Sometimes we'd go into town together, but if, you know, if they weren't prepared to go into town, I had to need sticks. That used to be, you know, the only time that it was separate. If you turn around and say you didn't quite fit in, answer me one question. Why did it take them 2 years to suddenly realise that I couldn't have fitted in?
I understand a lot of fans in Liverpool were furious, and there were practically riots at some of the performances once Ringo was part of the band. People chanted, Pete forever, Ringo never.
Yes, that did happen. It was very heartwarming. You know, there was petitions sent to the Merseybeat. George Harrison got a black eye off an irate fan. Brian was threatened. Deep down inside, it was very heartwarming, but I think I realised that no matter what they did, even though there was a show of force and a show of love, they couldn't reverse the decision.
Now, just a few months after you were booted out, the Beatles' song Love Me Do became this enormous hit, and then next year they were huge. They were an international phenomenon. You must have been pretty bitter.
I think initially it wasn't so much them becoming the international phenomenon. That was something, you know, the icons in the music industry, this, you know, incredible reputation they acquired. That was something, if you look back in hindsight and you're totally truthful, that was beyond, you know, the realms of our belief at that time. But what the annoying factor was, yes, the self-belief we had in ourselves that we were going to get a record into the English charts was starting to take shape. It was that initial first release. That was the one which started everything. Then, of course, after that, you know, it was followed up with, you know, other number ones. That was where the pain came in, because you were that close to it.
Now, there actually is a recording of Love Me Do when you were still there. You're on the drums. What do you think of the recording that you did?
I've always said it was good. I mean, you know, the version which was released on the anthology after many, many years, it's not a finished version. It was a version which we laid down to give George Martin a sample of the type of music that we were playing, to give him an idea of, you know, the harmonies, you know, there were possible changes which could have been made to it. But it was there. It was basically to turn around and show him that this was the type of music that we wanted to play. This was going to be our first release.
Love, love me do. You know I love you. I'll always be true. So please, love me do.
Now, when the Beatles anthology came out in the mid-90s, it featured 10 songs with you on drums, and I suppose it was maybe the first time when you kind of had official status as being one of the original Beatles. Was that a gratifying moment for you?
It was. You know, a lot of people have always looked at the financial view of it. The financial aspect of it was great. I wasn't expecting it, a little bit icing on the cake.
You got some royalties for the first time.
That's right, yes. You know, after many, many years, I did actually receive something, you know, for, you know, my work as a Beatle, you know, royalty-wise. But the other side of the coin was the fact that Anthology 1, I was on 10 tracks out of 60. It was a little bit like, well, you know, maybe this is their way of turning around and saying thank you for services rendered in the past.
You sort of kicked around for a while, sort of seeing if you could make it as a musician. You ended up working most of your career as a civil servant in the job center there. Were you kind of left alone, or were you hounded at all as being one of the first Beatles?
I think the recognition was there. You know, at that time, I still lived in Liverpool. I still walked the streets in Liverpool. I still drank in the same pubs. When I actually started, it was a little bit of a surprise to people. So, yes, there was an air of curiosity. There was an air of puzzlement. You know, Liverpoolians are outspoken. They'll look across the desk and turn around and say, aren't you the so-and-so who played for the Beatles? You know, what the hell are you doing working in the job centre? And, you know, you explain the position to them, you have a laugh and a joke. And at the end of the day, they realise that, OK, you are trying to, you know, persevere and gain security for your own family.
Now, I understand you are now in your early 60s and you've had a lot of years to think back on, well, over your career, over your life, what might have been if you had stayed with the Beatles. How do you put things in perspective when they became so big, so huge, and you had an entirely different life?
I think it's something you accept. It's something you'd entered into through your own volition. Yes, there wasn't a, you know, there's still an enigma about the dismissal, but you have to adjust your own lifestyle. And I think if you're content with what you're doing, you're pleased with what you're doing, and you're happy with what you've achieved music-wise and what you've achieved family-wise, because at the end of the day, family is number one. You know, if you've provided security for them, you've made sure that they've grown up with a good roof over their heads, they've had a good education, you're proud of your children, they're proud of the parents. I think you've done well, and it's a decision you make. The accolades which come from that are superficial, but it's wonderful to be in a position where you can turn around and say, yes, I've enjoyed life regardless of what happened 40-odd years ago. I've still got my health, I've still got my happiness, I've still got my humour. I'm still respected as a musician, you know, whether it be as an ex-Beatle or Pete in his own right. I've still got a wonderful family. I've still got brothers who stand around me. I've got two wonderful daughters, a wonderful wife. I've got four wonderful grandchildren who I idolise and spoil soft, and most probably always will. I've got a great band, you know, which is doing well. We're accepted. We're pulling crowds in. You know, people are enjoying it. People are starting to talk about the Pete Best Band in its own right. When you put all that together and you put it into perspective, I feel that I'm the fortunate one. I think I'm the lucky one.
You're so young and I'm so old. This my darling, I've been told. I don't care just what they say, 'cause forever I will pray. You and I will be as free as the birds up in the trees. Oh,
the song Diana, played by the Pete Best Band. Pete and his brothers Rogue and Rory have put out a book called The Beatles, The True Beginnings. It's the story of the Casbah Coffee Club in Liverpool, which will soon reopen to the public.